For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to our last podcast for 2020. It's been a hell of a year, literally, and it certainly will live in the memory. We thought we'd round out the year by having a chat with the MJA's Editor-in-Chief, Laureate Professor Nick Talley. Nick's been in the media quite a bit this year as one of many steadying voices from the medical sector during the COVID crisis. Welcome to the pod, Nick. I remember back in February very clearly, you started talking to us, the editorial team, about COVID, and you were already quite worried. What was it that made your ears perk up about COVID that early?
Well, I was reading the literature and also, you know, scanning the reports coming out of China about the virus. Mm. And to me, there were red flags. We could be in significant trouble, particularly with international travel, particularly with the fact that there were so many people that seemingly could transmit infection. And indeed, there were starting to be reports of transmission from particularly international travellers. So, yes, I got extremely worried in February. I thought we probably really needed to take action then. It took a little bit longer to take action, but we did take some at that early stage in Australia, which was very good, actually. And then luckily we took sufficient action a little bit later in March and April that I think was incredibly important for containing this before it became a real threat.
What were the red flags for you? I mean, I know I saw a report and I have no idea how true it was, that the Chinese were welding people into their homes. And I thought, oh, okay. What was it for you?
I remember there was a report in The Lancet that I saw that, you know, raised my concerns about, you know, all these cases emerging and not much known about this, although the virus had been sequenced. I'd never been in a pandemic before myself, but I've read about these in the epidemiology classic textbooks. And I thought to myself, oh, my goodness, we may be having one of these. And I may be living through it. Yeah. So that's what happened really for me.
I remember I had a conversation with Will Cairns, who you may recognise. He's a palliative care guy up in Townsville, and he writes regularly for Insight. And we had a conversation in January, actually, where he was writing something about disaster management for me. And he said, you know this COVID thing out of China? And I said, oh, yeah. And he said, I think we might be in trouble. And I remember thinking, what? Come on. And I remember giving you much the same response when you said...
Oh, yes, I got that response from lots of people. It's understandable because, of course, previous outbreaks that people were worried about, you know, really were contained, really didn't affect Australia, for example. Mm. And so it's easy to be lulled into a sense of, oh, we're all okay down here. But, of course, in the end, most of the world hasn't been okay. Mm.
When you look around the world now, we've gotten off pretty lightly, haven't we?
We've done very well in Australia. I think a combination of very good public health advice, government actually listening to experts, the community keeping it together in a tough time, and really, because it's really the community that drove this infection, you know, down to such low levels. Because if people had not followed the advice, if people refused to do what had been suggested, if many had, then we would be like the United States, perhaps, or the UK, and really facing a terrible time. So I think that combination, a little bit of luck too, a little bit of luck, and that always is a good piece of it. Victoria wasn't quite so lucky. They had the worst of it, really.
No. Do you attribute any blame in that second wave? I mean, obviously there were faults with the quarantine system.
Look, I think it's really hard to attribute blame in a complex setup where things are going to go wrong. It was unfortunate that the virus, you know, really got into communities that allowed spread to become significant before it was widely recognised. That was just bad luck, I think, to a large extent. Clearly, though, hotel quarantine approaches were not adequate. And in fact, there have been other outbreaks since suggesting that we need to tighten it even more. And this has happened. So I guess, you know, to be expected that there'd be outbreaks, just unlucky in Victoria, very unpleasant, thankfully now resolved, at least for the moment.
Do you think that is just for the moment? Do you think we've got more coming?
Well, it's very hard to believe it's going to be totally contained over the next several months. Yeah. I certainly hope the vaccination program will start here next year and it'll start to contribute to controlling this even more and reducing everyone's concerns too. Yeah. But it's going to be hard to stop overseas travellers, you know, infecting others and then spread occurring. It's hard to imagine that couldn't still happen despite the tightest controls. Yeah. So it's going to take enormous vigilance, and we'll probably have some minor outbreaks, perhaps more serious outbreaks over the next few months. We'll just have to wait and see. I think the biggest worry is the Christmas holiday period where families will all get together, of course, and one could argue that will be when there is real risk, and we'll just have to hope that we don't get too many super spreader events, which seem to be one of the significant issues in community transmission becoming more widespread. So all we can do is be vigilant. The testing rates are sort of starting to fall a bit, and that worries me as well, because people probably with symptoms are thinking, well, it can't be COVID, but of course it could be. Yeah. And so I'm hoping people will continue to band together and do the right thing, at least until we've really got a significant amount of the population vaccinated.
Hoping for the best that this is the worst of it done. What are the silver linings we can take? What have we learned about our health system that we can take forward and make permanent?
I think we've learnt a number of things. We've learnt that if public health is going to work, it's a very silent success story. If it's not working, then it's a very loud failure story. And I think that's become obvious with this pandemic. I mean, if you succeed in controlling it, everything seems good and no one seems to be doing much. And that's a real signature for success. So that's a public health message we need to get out, not just for, you know, infectious outbreaks, but also other chronic disease public health issues that are also silent killers and that need to be addressed more effectively. I think we've learnt that our health system is complex but able to respond. The ICU bed increase, for example, was which we haven't had to use, thankfully, really was impressive. And I think that's a great reflection on the system. I think we also learned that healthcare workers as frontline providers really are at risk in pandemics, and we need to protect them better. And I don't think we did a good enough job with this. I think the aged care failures were real lessons in the complexities of that part of the system. Wow. The level of workers that are, you know, involved in that system and their training and the issues around this and how to improve that and how to avoid future events like the outbreaks in the aged care centres that really shouldn't have happened. So I'm hoping that aged care really will get a boost and a lift up that will end up providing not only more protections from these kinds of outbreaks in the future, but a better aged care system for everybody, because, you know, we're all affected by this. Families everywhere are affected, and we want the best aged care system possible. I think our public health workers, you know, really have performed magnificently, and the trace and testers have been enormously impressive. I think that's a real compliment, considering, for example, in the US, where they've given up on trying to trace because they just can't. And that's just amazing in comparison to where we are. It's going to get worse in the US, and it's really very distressing to see.
There's been a lot of evangelism about telemedicine in the last, telehealth in the last 6 months or so. Are you a convert? Do you think it's going to be as big as people think it is?
I know there's a lot of people who are strongly in favour of telemedicine, and certainly the government's now funding this, which is a big change, change in the system. Certainly many patients like the fact they can not have to travel, they can speak to their doctor or their specialist and not have to actually front for a long wait, perhaps in an outpatient or in an office. So there are all those advantages. And for delivery of care to more remote Australians, there's real pluses. But as a frontline clinician too, there are some limitations to telemedicine that aren't talked about that much. But, you know, some of the clues and the cues that you get from a face-to-face encounter, you don't get from telemedicine as easily. There are some issues around that need further work. And if they can be addressed, it'll be an even better telemedicine model. I think clinicians vary in their enthusiasm. I think many still like to see people patients face-to-face because that's how they've been trained. So there's some of that as well to deal with going forward. But I think telemedicine is here with us and will expand in scope over time.
I'm chatting today with Professor Nick Talley, Editor-in-Chief of the Journal, and one of the world's leading neurogastroenterologists. Nick's editorial is available at mja.com.au, where it is open access. You can catch up with all our podcasts at mja.com.au/podcasts. They're free to download. As I said, this is our last podcast for 2020, but fear not, gentle listener, we will be back in 2021, starting on the 25th of January. You can subscribe to our 2021 feed through iTunes or Spotify. Back to our chat. You're a big traveller. I know you haven't had to do much this year. What has this pandemic done for the international academic scene in terms of networking, sharing, getting together and talking about stuff? How has that scene been changed?
Well, it's been changed very dramatically. The conferences have gone from face-to-face to virtual only, if they were held. Many were cancelled. Yeah. Those that have been held virtually have had... it's hard to judge. More variable success. A lot of the value of those big conferences is actually running into people, talking to people, having sidebar conversation, building relationships, and that's how research, for example, can grow. That's all been a lot more challenging this year with COVID and with the conference change. Mm. So people are presenting their work, and there are educational activities ongoing, but I think also much smaller audiences, I'm guessing, yeah. and probably more difficulties in some of the usual building of research activity. So it has affected this part of what we do. We've been very lucky in Australia. We've been able to, large parts of the country, keep research going, even though COVID's been around. Yeah. And that's been a very different from other parts of the world where people have really not been able to do this. Yeah. So the pandemic certainly affected research directly and indirectly. And of course, many have turned their resources to COVID research just because that's been the primary problem, which means some other areas perhaps have languished. I don't think conferences are going to go away in the future. I suspect there will be more virtual conference offerings, though, as sort of side by side with actually going. And I think they'll be done it better than they've ever been done in the past. Yeah. So they'll be the positives out of this. But I still think humans need to interact in general.
Yes.
And that is not likely to fully disappear. But one good benefit of all of this, I must say, is the carbon footprint of international airline flying definitely has been reduced. And in fact, you can argue that benefits to the climate of this pandemic may not be inconsiderable, both in terms of some direct effects, but also indirectly people realising, well, we don't want to face these kinds of challenges and more serious challenges in the future. Let's do something about climate change.
Well, that's the other big issue of the year, isn't it, after the summer we had last year? I feel like the bushfires last summer have shut a few people up. and I say that as editor of Insight. I mean, every time we run a climate change story, we get the usual suspects coming on and telling us how wrong we are. They haven't done that this year, which I thought has been really interesting. I think things are switching around.
I think there's a change as well. It's always hard to judge, but I believe there's more of the population who are now convinced this is a real problem. Mm. We are facing health issues from this problem right now. The bushfires, the Black Summer bushfires, were absolutely terrifying and devastating. And as someone who lives in the country myself, outside of the, you know, main city, you know, it was a terrible period, that bushfire period. It was literally terrifying. And I think if you weren't aware of climate change before that, I think you may well be now. And the facts are very clear. The facts that the planet is warming and there are real serious issues related to this with the changing climate. I think that's all becoming clear. I'm proud of the MJA's role in working with the Lancet to have the MJA Lancet countdown, the country countdown, providing local views, local evidence, local stories about the impact of climate change on health, so that Australians can be aware of the impact directly here. I'm pleased too that there appears to be a change in governments, many governments now, about climate change, who were perhaps more reluctant over recent years.
Yeah. Talk to me about net zero. You've written about that in your latest editorial, but just give us a brief rundown on what you mean by it.
The health system in Australia produces somewhere between 4 and 7% of the sort of carbon dioxide outputs for the whole of the nation, something like that, which is not insignificant. And so that means that, those of us who work as health professionals are contributing to climate change both directly and indirectly. And there's an opportunity to really do something about this at local levels and at state levels. And nationally. And it can be pushed along by health professionals recognising this and indeed advocating very strongly and showing that they can change this. And so my view is, and this is similar to the view that's been expressed by the leadership of the NHS in the United Kingdom, my view is, we should be able to, and we should, in fact, drive down our CO2 emissions to net zero by, as soon as possible, but certainly, by 2040. And if we help to do this, the hope remains most other sectors would indeed aim for similar kinds of targets. And I think there's some really positive signs this is going to happen anyway, but I think we need to push it along a little bit more. Victoria and Western Australia both now are directly moving in this direction. And other states and territories also have ambitions to in fact reduce the state CO2 output to net zero. And I think all of this bodes well for leadership and for change in the country. And some people say, Australia contributes very little to the total global issue. But the trouble is, if we don't lead, how can you expect anyone else to? Yeah. And everybody needs to do their bit. Every individual, every organisation, every business, every sector. So that's the idea. We should all be doing our bit. And if we do, we can all make a difference. Together.
Do you want to talk a bit about what kind of year the journal's had? I mean, it's been mad.
So the MJA's had an interesting year.
Yes.
And I think that's probably the summary. So obviously what happened to the journal, as has happened to other major journals around the world, is when COVID hit, and this was in March, suddenly, first of all, submissions rocketed up, and we had at the MJA essentially a doubling of submissions to the journal, which has certainly increased our workload. At the same time, the deputy medical editor staff and the structural editor staff needed to start working from home full time. So that was some adjustment there, coupled with that increasing volume. And then we have a public health crisis, and the journal looked very hard at and made the decision very rapidly to include preprints, have a preprint server on the MJA platform, so that urgent, important information, evidence-based, peer-reviewed where possible, but even if not peer-reviewed, internally reviewed and then placed out there as quickly as possible, so that useful information could be used by government, used by health professionals, and applied, hopefully, to make a difference in terms of the outcome. We set this preprint server up, and that's been extremely popular. And we've had a very significant uptake of articles that have been preprints that have really influenced government and been widely quoted and influential, although there's also been some critique of all of this, of course.
Is it something you can see going beyond the public health emergency?
Yes, I think so. I see a big change in medical publishing. The online getting out there faster is something that that everybody wants. But those who consume the information, those who actually produce the information, produce the science or the reviews, etc. Everybody wants this. And also, if there are proper checks and balances, this can be done, at least in my view, really pretty well. It's always nice to aim for perfection, but it sometimes in emergencies you can't have that. Despite the risks of pre-printing, I think most of the sector feels this is something that they like and want to see happen anyway. So I can see pre-prints being routine for many, many papers in the future, and journals publishing the ones they feel are appropriate in full. Some others will end up never being published, of course, but that's the way it will run.
Let's hope 2021 isn't like this one.
I think 2021 is going to be a better year. At least I hope so. I think it's shaping up to be a better year. COVID vaccine coming. Yes, it won't be perfect, but it'll make a real difference over time.
Yep.
I think climate change will be tackled a little bit more effectively, and I think the urgency is finally filtering down to lots of people. So I think that we're going to see some action there. I'm convinced the social determinants issues are also top of mind for many. Although the solutions aren't as clear, and that's where we need some innovation and change. But I think that's coming as well. And medicine will continue to advance. And I think, life will return back to more normal sometime, hopefully, towards the end of next year, end of 2021. Thank you very much for having me on the podcast.
Thanks, Nick.
Cheers. Thanks, Kate.
My thanks to Nick for his thoughts today. On behalf of the editorial staff of the Medical Journal of Australia, we'd like to wish you a happy and safe summer. And thanks to all my guests this year for being so free with their time and their thoughts. We'll see you again in 2021. Thanks for listening.